Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This morning, Donald Trump urged Republicans in Pennsylvania to challenge the state's new congressional map, which was drafted and approved by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, after it ruled that a 2011 gerrymandered map violated the state constitution's guarantee of free and equal elections. Trump tweeted, quote, "Your original was correct. Don't let the Dems take elections away from you so that they can raise taxes and waste money," end quote. Courts have also ruled that gerrymandered maps in North Carolina and Texas are unconstitutional. Supreme Court decisions affecting gerrymandering in Texas, Wisconsin, and Maryland will have a major impact on future elections. We have done a lot of shows about gerrymandering over the years, and it's really worth repeating that in 2012, Democrats running for Congress got 1.4 million more votes than Republicans. But because of gerrymandering, Republicans held the House. Republicans also won majorities in states across the country, even though Democrats got far more votes. So what does this all mean for the upcoming elections? Joining us to talk about gerrymandering is Michael Lee, senior counsel for the Democracy Program at New York University's Brennan Center, where he focuses on redistricting, voting rights, and elections. And Michael joins us from New York. Hi, Michael, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Thank you for joining us. Interesting timing that Donald Trump tweeted this morning about what's going on in Pennsylvania. Let's talk a little bit about Pennsylvania. I mean, this is major. This is a major decision. And you wrote about the landmark partisan gerrymandering ruling and what it means. First off, how bad was Pennsylvania's map in 2011?
So Pennsylvania's map, passed in 2011 by a Republican legislature and signed into law by a Republican governor, was easily among the most biased maps of the decade. It's up there with North Carolina and Michigan in terms of its skew in favor of one party or the other, and you know, under any number of metrics. And so it deserved to be struck down, and it was.
You write that even in very strongly Democratic cycles like 2012, Republicans have safely won 13 out of 18 Pennsylvania congressional seats. In fact, not a single congressional seat in Pennsylvania has changed hands between parties all decade. So talk a little bit about how things shifted in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, so the map that was passed in 2011 basically was designed to keep Democrats at five seats, barring some kind of extraordinary tsunami wave. Democrats would only win five seats, and even with a tsunami wave, they were only likely to win 7 out of 18 seats. So a minority, which is really strange given that Pennsylvania is a classic battleground. It's a 50-50 state that elects both Democrats and Republicans at the statewide level. Donald Trump won it, but it also elected a Democratic governor in 2014 and has elected other Democrats at statewide levels. And so Pennsylvania is a state that you would expect naturally would be very robustly competitive at the congressional level, just as it is at the statewide level. But that wasn't the case under this map. And Republicans safely have had 13 out of 18 seats all decade. And that's sort of the problem. Not only do they have you know a disproportionate share of seats, but the results were locked in, essentially rendering elections meaningless. You know, you could have a really strong year like 2012, and Democrats would win five seats, and you could have a more strongly Republican year like 2016 in Pennsylvania for Republicans, and Democrats win five seats, and that's really at odds with the political geography of Pennsylvania, which is very robustly, you know, it's pink and light blue if you look at sort of a precinct level map, and that's what you would expect that you would have really robust politics, and you didn't. And this the map that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court put in place is very, very different in the sense that it's highly responsive to election swings. So as Democrats win more votes, they get more seats, and as Republicans win more votes, they get more seats. And so you know, the winner in this really are Pennsylvania voters, who will see a lot more competition and a lot more elections that actually mean something.
The Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that a 2011 gerrymandered map violated the state constitution's guarantee of free and equal elections. How significant was that ruling?
it was very significant in the sense that up until now, most challenges to partisan gerrymandering have been brought in the federal courts, and the federal courts have famously deadlocked on whether partisan gerrymandering is actually something that even courts should be considering. And so the last time the court really considered it back in 2004, 2006, it famously split 4-4-1 with four of the justices saying that this wasn't even an issue that courts should take up at all. Another four justices, the liberal justices of the day, saying, yes, this map was unconstitutional, but not agreeing on a standard. And Justice Kennedy, in a very familiar spot in the middle, saying, well, he didn't think that this map was unconstitutional, but he was unwilling to say that courts could never entertain a partisan gerrymandering claim. And since then, a lot of lawmakers around the country have seen those decisions as green lights to do whatever they want, to go to town as long as they can put a political label on it. And you saw that really clearly in North Carolina, which we can come to in a minute. But, you know, so up until now, everything has been in federal court. The Pennsylvania case was brought in state court under the state constitution, and it's the first ruling striking down a map under a state constitution where there wasn't sort of an express provision dealing with partisanship. And it really could serve as a model for other states. It could signal at a minimum a second front on the war against partisan gerrymandering, regardless of what federal courts do in a couple of cases that they're considering this term.
Republicans in Pennsylvania fought very hard against attempts to change the map. You had some choice words in a U.S. News and World Report about this. You said that this is kind of a screw you to the court, which is unprecedented. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, they really – it's and it's not over yet. You know, Pennsylvania Republicans said that they weren't going to comply with the court's order. It didn't really sort of matter because they didn't have the information that the court wanted. But they went out of their way to say, we're not going to comply, before putting in a footnote. And by the way, we don't have the information that you want anyway. And then they really didn't try to redraw the map when given a chance. They instead went to the U.S. Supreme Court to try to block the map, despite the fact that this was a ruling under Pennsylvania state constitution. That was rejected by Justice Alito in a decision that he made by himself. These requests to stay rulings usually go to the whole court to consider, but Justice Alito, like a single justice, can decide it if the claim is really frivolous. And Justice Alito by himself decided it, signaling that even he, one of the more conservative justices on the court, thinks that the claims that Republicans were making about how this violated federal law were very frivolous. But despite all of that, despite having lost one time in the Supreme Court, Pennsylvania Republicans are signaling just today that they are going to file a new suit, whether in federal court or state court, making arguments that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court overstepped its bounds in ordering the map to be redrawn and adopting a new map, which, you know, you might term the Hail Mary of Hail Marys. But nonetheless, this fight is going on, and it just tells you how important protecting the gains that you have from gerrymandering can be to parties, and to the lengths to which they will go to try to keep, you know, every single seat that they get through partisan gerrymandering.
How was the map redrawn in Pennsylvania? Because that's always the big question. Who has the power to do this? Will it be citizens? How was the decision made in Pennsylvania?
So the Pennsylvania process, the court struck down the map on January 22nd. And of course, this is an election year and elections are about to happen in the Pennsylvania primaries in mid-May. And so you really needed to get a map in place very, very quickly. And so the court, being very deferential to the legislature, said, look, you guys have a chance to redraw the map, and if you can agree with the governor, I'll review it. We will review it, but that sort of, we will respect the political process if you sort of agree to a map. They did not, and instead, they didn't even vote on a map in the legislature. And instead, everyone submitted proposed maps to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. The court appointed a special advisor, Professor Nate Persily out of Stanford University, and he helped the court come up with a map based on, you know, looking at all of the submissions that people had, but then ultimately deciding on its own what the map would look like. That's, you know, in the ideal world, not how it would go. In the ideal world, you would have citizens involved, and you would have, you know, lots of input and lots of chance to look at proposed maps. But of course, there's an election coming up, and as is oftentimes the case, the need really was to avoid disruption to an ongoing election process. And so the court ended up drawing the map that's not, despite what some people will say, very unusual. That happens all the time. And if you are from Texas or North Carolina, you know that courts redraw the maps all the time because you've had a history of redistricting litigation. That's certainly something that's new for Pennsylvania, but it's not new around the country.
Today, we're speaking with Michael Lee, Senior Counsel for the Democracy Program at New York University's Brennan Center, where he focuses on redistricting, voting rights, and elections. And today, we are talking about gerrymandering. We are seeing courts intervene in many states and rule that gerrymandered maps are unconstitutional. I hope you've heard this number many times. Republicans held the House in 2012, even though Democrats got 1.4 million more votes. And it's because of gerrymandered maps. Now gerrymandering is starting to get more attention and a lot more people are focusing on it. But Michael, it's really important to talk about how we got here. We've had David Daly on from Salon, who's written a book about this, and he had a new piece in Salon just about what went down in 2010 with a number of, actually 2009, a number of Republicans had gatherings with very high donors like a Walmart and Comcast and asked them to pour millions of dollars into their efforts to redraw maps. And that happened in 2010. Now that we have learned about how all of this went down behind the scenes, what really strikes you the most about how they've been able to really pull this off?
Well, you know, and when it came time for the redistricting in 2011 and the lead up to that, Democrats were a little asleep at the wheel. Republicans realized, and Karl Rove and others realized, that if they could gain control of state legislatures and governorships, they could control redistricting and get to draw the congressional maps however they wanted. And they put a lot of effort into that. Democrats were a little bit coasting along. But, you know, what strikes me is that that is no longer the case. Democrats have signaled very strongly that they are going to be players in the redistricting wars of 2021. President Obama and Eric Holder have already committed to raise hundreds of millions of dollars to try to, they would say get a seat at the table. Other people would say, you know, try to, like, you know, have the position to be able to gerrymander. Regardless of what the motivation is, there, you know, Americans are looking forward to an all-out redistricting war in the lead up to 2021, and then also in 2021 as people deploy much more sophisticated data to draw maps ever more perniciously. That is if the Supreme Court or other courts don't put limits on this. What Americans are looking at is, you know, a round of redistricting unlike anything that we've seen thus far. If you thought that the maps in 2021 were bad, and they by every objective standard were, by 2011, I'm sorry, and if, you know, by every objective standard they were, the maps of 2021 are going to be even worse, because we will have much more data about who you are based on your Google searches, based on what kind of car you drive, based on your credit scores, and people will be able to know stuff about voters at the household level, about not only how likely it is that you are to vote in a midterm election versus a presidential election, but how likely you are to support candidate X or candidate Y. And that will make gerrymandering even easier. And that's why it's really, really important that the Supreme Court or courts like the Pennsylvania Supreme Court step in and signal that there are at least some limits on partisan gerrymandering.
And where is this information coming from?
It's ever becoming more sophisticated. This is the sort of stuff that political campaigns and marketers and others have long used to sort of identify voters. But, you know, you can buy a lot of this data, just from commercial sources, you know, and things like that. So who subscribes to what magazine and things like that. And you can develop profiles of voters that are very sophisticated. It used to be that you knew in a precinct or a census block that it was 50% Democratic and 50% Republican, but you didn't know where the Democrats or Republicans necessarily lived within that block. And unless you had on-the-ground knowledge. But now you do. You can go down the street and say, ah, this is a Democratic household. Ah, this is a Republican household. And, you know, this stuff was in its infancy in 2011 when we last redrew all of the nation's congressional and legislative maps. It will be much more sophisticated by the time we get to 2021. And that's scary. And people should be alarmed.
If you have any questions or comments about gerrymandering, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Here in California, a voter group's pushed for districts to be drawn by citizens, not politicians, and we'll get an update on how that went just after the break. If you took part in that, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on social media. We're joined by Michael Lee, Senior Counsel for the Democracy Program at New York University's Brennan Center. Michael, you know, there are a lot of things going on here. You've got gerrymandering, you have voter ID laws, a number of other voter suppression laws that have been passed by Republicans. And that's directly connected to gerrymandering because Democrats lost 1,000 state legislative seats nationwide under the Obama administration. So because we saw so many state houses completely controlled by Republicans, they were able to pass laws that make it very difficult for people, especially poor people and people of color, to vote. As someone who really studies this, talk a little bit about how this has really affected elections over the years.
Yeah, there's no question that increasingly there's an effort to game the system so that you can guarantee the results that you want, or at least put your thumb on the scale in a heavy way to sort of make it harder for your opponents to win elections. And that's, you know, we've always had rough and tumble politics, but this is really something that is new, and there's sort of an existential feel in a lot of ways to our politics. And it originally was in states like Texas and North Carolina that were very fast growing and changing demographically. But increasingly, you're seeing it in states like Pennsylvania and northern states as people really try to put to gain every advantage they can, and they worry that if they can't win elections, and so as a result, they're going to win by other ways. And you know, that's something that's very alarming and very disturbing because, you know, all of these laws, you know, particularly voter ID laws, are being passed without any evidence that there is a problem. It's really a solution in search of a problem. And then even the solution isn't very carefully tailored. If it's carefully tailored at all, it's carefully tailored to exclude the sorts of IDs that African-Americans and Latinos and others are more likely to have. In fact, a court in North Carolina found that that state's voter ID law and its elections laws passed in 2013 surgically targeted African Americans, and the words that the court used were surgically precise. And so, it is deeply alarming, and it's continuing in states like North Carolina, where you see efforts to redraw or change the way that judges are elected, to change the composition of county election boards, and all of this seems very heavy-handed. And again, it's started in states like Texas and North Carolina, but it seems to be spreading because people seem to have this feel that everything's it's on the table and you've got to be in power, and though they seem determined to hang on to power however they can.
Can you also talk about the money behind this? Because we're talking about big money and major corporations. In Dave Daly's piece for Salon, he writes about the Republican State Leadership Committee, and that's the group that designed the strategy called Red Map, which is short for Redistricting Majority Project. And this is the technology that was able to put all of these maps together. He writes that former Republican National Committee Chair Ed Gillespie was in charge of the RSLC, the Republican State Leadership Committee. And between 2008 and 2010, he was looking to reel in about $30 million from companies like AT&T, Walmart, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Big Oil, and then they would use that money to redraw the maps. What strikes you about the big players behind this push?
Yeah, there's no question that the loosening of campaign finance laws has contributed in a big way, or as the president might say, a bigly way, to this problem in that Now it's easy to raise millions and even hundreds of millions of dollars through dark money vehicles where you can hide who you are and play in these elections in ways that you weren't able to do in the past. And that's really a driver of a lot of this. And so it's sort of this downward cycle where, you know, one thing feeds into another, where it's easy to sort of put millions of dollars into elections and to gain control of legislatures and then change the rules of the game in a way that your opponents are disadvantaged. And, you know, that's deeply alarming. I keep using the phrase deeply alarming, but all of this is, it's just really, you know, and it's going to get worse. And, you know, that's why, again, it's so important that the Supreme Court act and put some limits on, or that's citizens in states like California mobilize and, you know, pass better ways of doing this. And so it's really critical.
Let's take a call before break. Let's go to Jonathan in San Francisco. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. So my question is, you know, for this next war that's coming up between the Democrats and the Republicans for redistricting, I thought in order to really have a seat at the table, you have to be the party that controls the state legislature. And so with all the victories that the Republicans have already had with their gerrymandering, how is it the Democrats get back to the table?
Back to the redrawing table?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's usually controlled by the legislature.
Right. What about that, Michael?
Well, that's a great question. And ordinarily, the caller is absolutely right. You know, the maps that we use currently right now in many states are highly gerrymandered in favor of one party or the other. And Republicans had a really good year in 2010. And so they controlled redistricting in a huge number of states in 2011 and drew maps to their advantage. So, you know, most state legislative maps now favor Republicans to some degree and oftentimes to a high degree. And those maps are, they lock in a Republican advantage, which, could be one that survives until 2021. And that's a challenge. The one factor that could upset that is when you do these sorts of aggressive seat maximizing gerrymanders, when you try to get as many seats as you can possibly have, what you don't do is you don't draw districts that your party wins by 80%. Because if you do that, you're using your voters very inefficiently. Instead, what you want to do is you want to spread your voters, if you're the gerrymandering party, out as much as possible to win as many seats as possible. And so you draw districts that are, you know, instead of 80% wins, 52 or 53% wins, and that way you maximize the number of seats you have. The problem with that, of course, is that that's protecting against a 100-year flood, and it doesn't protect you very well against a 500-year or 1,000-year flood. And if you're a Republican looking at the landscape right now of 2018 and perhaps 2020, it starts to look like it might be a 500-year flood or maybe even a 1,000-year flood, in which case you have to worry that, lo and behold, your gerrymander might actually collapse and it might actually be Democrats who are in the driver's seat come 2021. That's the only saving grace, perhaps. But if you don't have that sort of wave, you're absolutely right. It is hard to overcome. The good news is that there's increasing bipartisan support around the country. People like John Kasich and John McCain and others who have spoken out against partisan gerrymandering. I think a lot of people on both sides of the aisle have realized that this is a problem, and that number is growing.
Thank you for the call, Jonathan. Today, we're speaking with Michael Lee, Senior Counsel for the Democracy Program at New York University's Brennan Center. He focuses on redistricting and voting rights. And today, we are talking about gerrymandering. This morning, Donald Trump urged Republicans in Pennsylvania to challenge the state's new congressional map. It was just approved by the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania after it ruled that a gerrymandered map violated the state's Constitution's guarantee of free and equal elections. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about a new dance performance from Robert Moses Kinn called Bootstrap Tales. It's part of the company's effort to help San Francisco foster youth find a career in the arts. It'll be performed February 23rd through the 25th at the YBCA in San Francisco. And then on Thursday, we will be talking about the public education crisis in this country. School teachers and service personnel from all 55 counties in West Virginia are going to have their first statewide walkout Thursday and Friday over concerns about pay and health care. And then in Oklahoma, this is so hard to believe, but in 90 school districts, schools are now closed on Mondays because they cannot afford to keep the schools open. Teachers are so desperate to make ends meet, they're either fleeing to neighboring states or getting jobs at Walmart. So we're going to talk about the crisis in public education on Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line. Your call at kalw.org. Your call at kalw.org. Today we are talking about gerrymandering, and if you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're joined by Michael Lee, Senior Counsel for the Democracy Program at New York University's Brennan Center. And now I would like to welcome Connie Galambos Malloy. Connie has been a member of California's Citizens Redistricting Commission since 2010 and is not affiliated with any political party. Hi, Connie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much.
Good morning. So California has been getting national attention because of how it is dealing with maps. Before we talk about that, how did you become a member of California Citizens Redistricting Commission?
Well, I put in an application along with 32,000 other Californians, and we went through a process that the Bureau of State Audit managed, that they went through and identified, narrowed the pool, which eventually they came out with a smaller list of qualified candidates that they forwarded to the legislature, and the legislature had an opportunity to review those final candidates and make some strikes from the pool. And at the end of the day, there were 36 of us remaining, 12 Democrats, 12 Republicans, and 12 no party preference, of which I'm one. And the first eight of us were actually drawn by a bingo ball. We call ourselves the Lucky Eight. And then the Lucky Eight, we got together, and using the criteria that had been established by the Bureau of State Audits, we then chose the remaining six from the pool that was left over. So you ended up with 14 of us, 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, and 4 no party preference.
Mm. Michael, what strikes you about how California is dealing with map drawing?
So California is a great testament to the power of the ability to reform map drawing to make it fairer. Before the commission came into effect, California had a very famous bipartisan gerrymander where everybody agreed, basically Democrats and Republicans, that they were all going to protect each other's seats. And if you were a Democrat, you were going to win re-election. If you're a Republican, you were going to win re-election. And so the map was very unresponsive to sort of electoral swings one way or the other. And when you have the commission come into effect, you actually see much fairer maps produced. The commission's maps, in fact, are a model of fairness if you measure it using any number of statistical methods. And that really is a testament to the way that the commission is set up. So it includes Democrats, Republicans, and independents. And to approve a map, you have to have approval from Democrats, Republicans, and independents each separately as a group, as well as overall. And that really has fostered negotiation and conciliation. And the other thing that California did really well is it has strong, clear, objective rules for the commission to follow, which is not the case in many states. And in many states, the rules around redistricting are very ambiguous. In California, you also had requirements, strong requirements of transparency and strong opportunities for public participation, all of which I think made the process much more informed and much more trustworthy. To this day, if you really wanted to, you could watch all of the commission's proceedings online from beginning to end. It is a model of, having strong rules, a model of transparency, a model of public participation, and among other things.
Connie, can you talk about the process behind the scenes and how politicians responded to this? Because ProPublica had a lengthy piece in 2011 called How Democrats Fooled California's Redistricting Commission. To get the districts they wanted, Democrats organized groups that said they represented communities but really represented the party. And in this piece, it says that voters put redistricting in the hands of citizens where decisions would be guided by public testimony. The question facing House Dems as they met to contemplate the new realities was delicate. How could they influence an avowedly nonpartisan process? So can you talk a little bit about that? What went on behind the scenes?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, we were there as commissioners on behalf of the voters of California, and our charge was to implement the ballot propositions that had been passed, the Voters' Choice Act and the Voters' Choice Act for Congress. The first act set us up as a commission that would oversee redrawing of the Assembly, Senate, and Board of Equalization districts for the state. And before we even got seated and into working, they decided to expand it and actually added on congressional maps. So by the time we were seated, we had the full charge over all of these maps. But it wasn't just kind of go and do what you think is best. We had a series of ranked order criteria that we had to apply in developing the maps. So, for example, equal population was first and foremost. We had to make sure that each of the districts was equally weighted. The Voting Rights Act was the second criteria, making sure that we were cognizant of the legal parameters around Section 5 at the time of the Voting Rights Act and how that had to take precedence as we looked at populations who had experienced irregularities in their ability to cast their vote. Were the areas contiguous? We had to ensure that all of the parts of a district connected to each other, right? We're not going to have one on one side of town and then connect it to something on the other side of town. The fourth criteria was around cities, counties, neighborhoods, and communities of interest, and doing our best to be able to keep those whole where possible. The fifth criteria was around compactness, trying to make sure that if you think about representation and folks being able to actually have access to their elected officials, that the ability to have reasonable sized districts was very important. And nesting. So, for example, the population size of two assembly districts can fit inside of a Senate district. And so where possible and where it didn't conflict with the preceding criteria, we were to look at the possibility of nesting. And I think from our last but definitely not least, from our perspective, the seventh criteria around no politics, we did not look at any information around seated politicians, incumbents, candidates, et cetera, or even party affiliation was just not on the table as part of our deliberation process. You asked about the hearings, and maybe I'll just say a bit about the process we used. So the first few months that the commission was seated, we had to set up shop. We had to create our own mini state agency just to be able to have the minimum level of staff and consultants to get the job done. Then we were privy to the census data that came out in the spring. And once we had the census data, again, going to that equal population criteria, we were able to then begin doing the hearings throughout the state to get feedback from the community that then we could pair with the hard data from the census. We did 34 public input hearings throughout the state, starting in April and ending in July. We went as far north as Redding and as far south as San Diego. We had aspirations of going even farther north. We also, of course, like other agencies, had budget limitations, so we really tried to go where we had large population centers and made sure to provide other ways for folks who were not geographically close to a hearing location to be able to submit their testimony online. Those hearings would range from 3 hours on the short end up to 6 hours on the longer end, where each person coming would have their minutes to be able to tell us what their opinions were, what they wanted to see in terms of political representation. So we directly heard from nearly 3,000 Californians verbally, and then over 20,000 additional public comments were submitted by email and by mail. All of those submissions are available to review for the public. And as Michael said, if you're really a glutton for punishment, you can pull up and watch the entire process from how we document it online. The thing I would say is in the hearing, you know, we were chosen and seated because of our skills and attributes that the Bureau of State Audits thought would be relevant to the job at hand, and also because we represented essentially a snapshot of California in terms of geography, in terms of gender and race and ethnicity and age, you name it. But of course, as we were sitting in the hearings, there are times where we would be presented with testimony that just didn't sit right, where we would have either a number of email submissions come in that were exactly the same language cut and pasted into an email, or where you would get testimony in a public hearing that had similar qualities. And I know, you know, we struggled as commissioners at first on how to deal with that. And there were times in the beginning stages where we might ask questions and engage with a particular person giving testimony. We actually decided that that was not an appropriate role for us to be doing cross-examination, if you will, because we didn't want there to be the perception that we were in any way having a chilling effect, and especially for people who'd never really engaged with a public process like this before. We wanted to make it very clear that we were open for business, we were transparent, we were welcoming, and that it was really our job to be able to sort out what the relevant data was and wasn't. So were there attempts to game the system? Absolutely. With something that's dealing with power and with real resources on the table, you can't imagine that there wouldn't be. But we as commissioners were very aware of that and took it seriously in terms of how we gauged what data was most relevant to the task at hand to inform those final maps.
Connie, speaking of power, politicians don't like to give up power. What was your relationship like with politicians during this process?
Well, we certainly had the impression that everyone in Sacramento wanted us to fail. And so there was the need to have to support us with a baseline level of infrastructure, certainly with the ballot propositions that were passed, that was codified in the law. Did anyone go beyond the letter of the law? Absolutely not. And we had to really be persistent in terms of getting help on everything from how can we buy pencils to making sure that we were able to hire the right staff and the consultants that we needed. So it was very challenging, but as Californians and as everyday citizens, we really identified with the purpose for which we had gone to Sacramento and across the state, and so that made us in some ways more eager and motivated to be able to demonstrate that there was an alternative to what has turned into the national norm, and that there was a more transparent and inclusive way to do redistricting.
And so overall, you think it was a fair process and everyone had a voice and it was a diverse group of people at the table?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it did feel like a great experiment in democracy and citizen-led democracy. You know, Michael mentioned the fact that we did have to reach a supermajority in order to approve the maps. So for the Assembly, Senate, and Board of Equalization maps, we approved those with a 13-1 vote. So 13 of the 14 commissioners in favor of the final set of maps, one commissioner voting against them. And for the congressional districts, we had 12 commissioners vote in favor of them, two commissioners voting against them. Mm-hmm. We finalized that at the end of July of 2011 and then posted them for public comment for 2 weeks and then came back and did the final vote. And those were 177 individual district maps with the lines to those maps, a narrative and a rationale for why we drew a map a particular way. So it's a dramatic improvement both in terms of process and in terms of outcomes to what we've had in California or, quite frankly, across the nation.
Connie, before we let you go, we have a question from Lisa who says, you know, so many people are now independent. How does gerrymandering affect them?
Well, I think gerrymandering affects all of us in terms of our ability to cast a vote and to have candidates that actually reflect the natures of our communities and our aspirations for what we want our state to look like. Certainly in California, we're ahead of the game in a way in terms of our data around the no party preference. You know, I'm very pragmatic. I'm a no party preference person. And to me, at the end of the day, it's around who's going to get the job done. What are the best policy alternatives on the table? What does leadership look like, no matter what side of the aisle that is on? And I think this process allows opportunity for any Californian, including independent voters, to express what they would like to see in terms of fair and effective political representation, and to also have representation on that commission itself, right? There are four of the 14 seats that were for no party preference individuals, which I think speaks volumes to the importance that this should have for decline to state voters or no party preference voters.
Well, Connie, thank you for all the information. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Connie Galambos-Molloy has been a member of California's Citizens Redistricting Commission since 2010 and is not affiliated with a political party. And joining us also is Michael Lee, Senior Counsel for the Democracy Program at New York University's Brennan Center. Michael, how would you respond to Lisa's question? If so many people are now becoming independents or declined to state, how does gerrymandering affect them?
Well, it affects them in a huge way. I mean, you know, in part because their voices actually aren't heard in the process. You know, most states, it is a political process. Maps are drawn by a legislature that consists almost wholly or wholly of Democrats and Republicans. And if one party's in control, their outlook, their goal is to maximize seats for their party or to protect incumbents or do all kinds of things. And the growing number of independents in states like California are shut out of that process. They don't get a chance to sort of weigh in on, you know, what maps should look like or, you know, what, you know, they consider would consider fair representation. And, you know, California is, you know, the model set up in California is the exact opposite of that in the sense that people can come and they can testify, they can present proposed maps, they can, you know, comment on proposed maps. That, you know, it is a very open process and everybody gets a role in that, and that really drives a much more nuanced and much richer process than when you only put on your partisan hat and decide, you know, whether people are D's or R's. And it California really has been a model of reform in that regard.
And the LA Times just reported that independents or no party preference, which is what we have here in California, are about to take over the registered Republicans. Independents are 24.95%. Republicans are 25.44%. Democrats in California are 44.63%. So when people register, what we're seeing right now is a lot of people are registering under no party preference.
Yep, absolutely. And I think that's the case around the country, an increasing number of people don't affiliate with one of the major parties. And they oftentimes tend to be more balanced politically. The one thing that we've seen is that, you know, both parties have gotten a little bit more extreme, the Republicans in particular. But, you know, independents are an important part of the electorate who don't, at least in the redistricting process right now, have a voice.
Well,
if
you have a question or comment, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. So we have an independent commission in California. There are also independent commissions in Idaho, Washington State, Montana, Alaska, Arizona. How are things going in those states?
Well, they're going well as wherever you have a commission in place, even a commission that doesn't necessarily work as well as California's, it tends to produce fairer maps, at least in terms of being biased in favor of one party or the other. California's does even better than all of those states because it has a more robust structure. But you simply having a commission, simply making sure that everybody has a seat at the table, or at least Democrats and Republicans have a seat at the table, goes a long way to producing fairer maps. And that's a big contrast to where you have one party in control of redistricting, as is the case in states like Texas or North Carolina or Pennsylvania in 2011. Simply having a commission, simply having everybody at the table produces much fairer maps. But you can go further, as California has, and having more independent people or people who are screened and vetted and are, have shown that they can be team players sitting at the table. Much, you know, you screen them much like you would a jury. You, if you have strong, clear rules, if you have transparency and public participation requirements, you have even better results. And the proof ultimately is in the pudding. California's maps are among the fairest in the nation. As one party wins more votes, it gets more seats, and vice versa. And so that's really what people think that democracy should look like, and that's what Californians got.
We have another question about independence. Let's hear from Anthony in San Francisco. Hi, Anthony. Welcome to the show.
And good morning. It seems really important to me that the playing field between Democrats and Republicans be more level. But for those of us who really believe that both of the major parties are corrupt and anti-democratic, what's the way forward?
Yes, important question. What is the way forward, Michael?
Well, you know, I think, you know, California has done a lot of, you know, in terms of, you know, having open primaries and having a system where independents can participate in the redistricting process. You know, whether it could go further and have, you know, ranked choice voting or multi-member districts or something like that. You know, there are a series of other reforms that at least some people have suggested might even improve California's responsiveness even more in terms of, you know, its electoral politics. And so, you know, those are certainly things that people have advanced and people should look at. You know, there are cities in California that are currently considering. Some of these are counties. Santa Clara County is considering adopting a ranked choice voting system, which, you know, tends to allow for more parties to participate and you know, changes the political landscape a little bit more. And that's certainly worth looking into.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Anthony. We're going to have a show in the next couple of weeks talking about progressive Democrats versus corporate Democrats. And a couple of people are speaking out about how corporate Dems are making it incredibly hard for progressive Democrats to run in a state like California. And that's coming up in the next couple of weeks. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Steve in Mountain View. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, I'm Steve Chesson, president of Californians for Electoral Reform. And we think that single-member districts are actually the problem, and debating over who should draw the lines is like debating who should be rearranging the deck chairs on a Titanic. I mean, the real solution is proportional representation in multi-member districts, because the problem with single-member districts is it only takes slightly more than half the vote in slightly more than half the districts in order to control a legislature. That sets the threshold of control at 25%. 25% of the voters can overwhelm the other 75%. If you have proportional representation in multi-member districts, if you use three-member districts, that raises the threshold of control to 37.5%, making it a lot harder to do a gerrymander. And if you have five-member districts, that raises the threshold of control to around 40-something percent. And there's actually a bill in Congress, the Fair Representation Act. It's H.R. 3057. One of the co-sponsors is Representative Ro Khanna from the Silicon Valley. And that would require states to use a proportional system to elect their representatives to Congress.
How much support does that have, Steve? I'm guessing,
well,
not much, unfortunately, right now.
It's got four co-sponsors. It was introduced by Representative Don Beyer from Virginia. Jamie Raskin, another progressive Democrat from Maryland, is one of the co-sponsors, as is Jim Cooper from Tennessee. Frankly, I don't think it's going to get through this particular Congress, but it's important that we change the discussion. I mean, I have one of my neighbors is a Republican, and one of my neighbors is a Democrat, and there's no way that a single congressional representative from my district can represent them both. What you really need is proportional representation so that all districts with multi-members will have both Democratic and Republican representation. Obviously, it's majority rule, but fair representation for the electoral minority. We need to change the discussion, stop arguing over who should draw the lines, and start discussing about changing the rules.
Well, thank you for calling, Steve. We'll put that on our show idea. This is the system we have. So right now, we have to talk about gerrymandering and how these maps are drawn, but we'll definitely put that on our idea list, proportional representation. I want to ask you quickly, Michael, we're almost out of time, about the November election. Dave Daly, and I keep going back to him because he's written such good articles and books about this. I wonder what you think. He says that the governor's races in November are very important and easier than flipping state legislative chambers. He says that in states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Republicans have kept control of chambers, sometimes with veto-proof supermajorities, even when Democrats get more votes. His main argument is that in November, a lot of people need to come out and vote. Democrats could still get more votes than Republicans this November and still lose. And so he says that right now, if some governors flipped, maybe you can see a little bit more balance. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, certainly that could be the case. It really sort of depends on the state. Many state legislative maps are highly gerrymandered in favor of one party or the other, in most cases Republicans. The only thing that is uncertain about this is that this could be a tsunami wave year that could produce Democratic legislatures. You know, the Virginia House of Delegates map, for example, was drawn to favor Republicans heavily. And yet in the November 2017 elections, Democrats came within a seat of taking a majority. Now, they won the popular vote by 11 points, so they still don't have a majority.
Wow.
But if you see something similar around the country, it's possible that some legislative chambers could fall as well. It just really depends on the national mood. And, you know, as I say, a week is a long time in politics. And although things look really favorable for Democrats right now, November is a long time away, and we'll see.
So Dems got an 11-point lead in Virginia, but they still didn't get the majority?
No, they're one seat short of a tie.
And just quickly, Michael, are any area states gerrymandered for Democrats right now like they are for Republicans?
There are some. If you look at Illinois, both its legislative plan and its congressional plan, Maryland, which is a state where the congressional map is being challenged in federal court as a Democratic gerrymander, and the Supreme Court is going to hear that case at the end of March. So there's no question that Democrats, given the opportunity, will gerrymander to their heart's content. It's just that the 2010 election put Republicans in charge in most places, not Democrats. Had it been the other way around, no doubt we would be talking about Democratic gerrymanders.
Michael Lee is Senior Counsel for the Democracy Program at New York University's Brennan Center. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And you can find more information about gerrymandering at yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, we will be joined by Artistic Director Robert Moses. He'll be speaking about the new dance performance Bootstrap Tales. It's part of the company's effort to help San Francisco foster youth find a career in the arts. It'll be performed February 23rd to the 25th at the YBCA in San Francisco. Your Call is produced here at KALW. You can find more information about the show or podcast the show. Share it with your friends at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thank you for joining us. It's Your Call.